Krishna. Akura is so happy he's laughing now. This is Reality Check. We're going to be talking about humility.
Jai.
And we're having so many problems with the computer that we're just laughing about it.
Yeah, it's there.
And it's actually working. It's working. It doesn't always work when we record. We don't know why. If someone out there doesn't like what we're saying. So there's a big topic I want to talk about, and it's fault finding and how it relates to humility. And the reason I want to talk about it is because Prabhupada has written that if we follow all the principles of Krishna consciousness, we will become Krishna conscious in this life. But he made a disclaimer in which he said, if you follow these principles, four regular principles, chanting 16 rounds, serve the Vaishnavas, etc., serve your guru, and do not offend devotees, you will become Krishna conscious. So that's a big thing, because basically he's saying that can nullify all the positive you do. And so one of the questions I have asked myself, or I've wondered about, which I think is an important question we all need to look at, is why do we become critical of other devotees? Because I thought, well, if I understand why, what's the cause, what's the root, then perhaps there's a chance I can stop doing it. Now, back to this conversation. Well, if I become Krishna conscious, I'll stop doing it. True. But on the way, you're doing it, and it's getting in the way of you becoming Krishna conscious. Just like Mahaprabhu says, chant in a humble state of mind. He doesn't say chant and wait to chant in a humble state of mind. So part of the discussion is also just to define what humility is. And then I came across this wonderful statement by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who said, until we begin to look at our own faults, we'll not stop looking at the faults of others. And I read this, I said, wow, this is really what I was, this was the answer I was looking for, because he's explaining the cause, that we are afraid, or not we, our false ego is afraid to look at what's wrong with ourself, and therefore, I mean, it's such difficult work to admit I've got deficiencies, especially if they're big. And it's hard to acknowledge that they're there, or often difficult to acknowledge that they're there. But rather, it's easier to see it in others, or our inclination is to see it in others rather than see it in ourselves. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, because I'm so honeycombed with faults, then I see the faults of others. So in the realm of psychology, they say exactly that. If something about somebody bothers you, it's because you have that, and you're not admitting, you're not acknowledging, you're not accepting it. Or they say, if you spot it, you got it. Now, every time you see it in another person, particularly if it really bothers you, that means you actually have that problem, and you're not acknowledging it, and you're not okay with it, and you're not working with it.
I have a friend who is an executive coach, and his whole work is around behavior and around helping successful leaders become even more successful. And the way he helps them is that he takes feedback from their peers, superiors, and subordinates, and it's a very comprehensive, it's 360-degree feedback, and then goes back to them, it's a confidential feedback, goes back to them and asks them to pick one thing they want to change. And basically what he's helping them with is to become more humble, because successful people, intelligent people, tend to be proud.
Because they're in a higher position than other people.
Yeah, so they have achieved a lot.
So they think they're better, naturally.
Yeah.
So it's even more difficult for them. The more, in a sense, the more qualified we are, the more intelligent we are, the more talented we are, the more difficult it can be for us to be humble.
So he charges $20 if you say but, no, or however.
So each time you say it, you have to pay $20.
And on top of his fees, his consulting fees. So he's training these top CEOs of huge companies to, for example, take feedback without saying anything, without saying, I agree, I disagree, being defensive. Just listen. If you're you know, if you're really into it, make notes and say thank you. That's all.
Painful for some people, I imagine.
Probably.
Well, you know, the thing that I've also been noticing within our Vaishnava, I don't want to say philosophy, but for lack of a better word, I will say philosophy. If you look at the attitudes, if you study the attitudes of advanced Vaishnavas, it's really directly opposite of what I was saying about this fear of looking inside into the what some people call the shadow, the dark side. It's actually the opposite. It's a total openness to look at it. Because you'll often see, a lot of times an advanced devotee, for example, may be asked to speak in the assembly of other advanced devotees, and he might say something like, I'm honored, I don't feel qualified, I'm in the association of more advanced people, but still I ask your blessings. So it's kind of a mode of operandus where an advanced devotee operates in that mood of, I'm not really qualified because I'm looking at those the impurities within me that I need to work on. I mean, that's the process of bhakti. And I was reading something really funny. It said, Duryodhana was so proud that he wouldn't eat the remnants of anyone's food. He wouldn't even eat his own remnants. So for example, if they gave him some preparation, they would put it in a number of bowls. So he'd take a spoonful from each bowl, but he wouldn't take a second spoonful from the same bowl because then he'd be eating his own remnants. So he'd take one spoonful from each bowl. And then it said he was so proud he didn't want anything above him, so he wouldn't even carry an umbrella because that would be higher than him.
Wow.
So you see the attitude of the non-devotee or materialist or the asura, as we say. They're very reluctant to look at their dark side. Whereas a devotee is supposed to be very open, not only open, but that's what his life is about, purification. You know, willingly looking at the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, then if we study what humility means, according to Mahaprabhu, he's not saying that humility means to find out what's wrong with other people. You know, so I'm lower than a blade of grass. Well, how could I think myself lower than a blade of grass unless I connect with that side of me or those things about me that need improvement? Sometimes, I don't know if you've ever heard this statement. It said, humility means reality. Because the reality is that we are dirty. But when there's no humility, pride comes, and then we think we're something we're not. We think we're better than what we are. Or even if we are good, then we might think, yes, it's my power, it's my ability, rather than Krishna has empowered me. So humility means just reality. The reality is, no, I am low, you're low, everyone is low. And the greater we become, what happens? The lower we think we are, not the higher we think we are, which is kind of a paradox materially, because as you're saying, materialists, it's hard for them to become humble, the qualified ones, successful ones. So in reading all these things, I felt like, okay, I think I'm getting to the root of this problem of fault finding, because everyone I know has the problem. They tell me, this is a problem for me. It's just like it's there. I don't want it to be there.
So Prabhupada is teaching us to be like a bee, not like a fly. Fly go to soars and bees go for honey. So apart from having some bad qualities, people have good qualities, and we should be able to recognize and appreciate those good qualities and not focus on something that is wrong in other people.
So again, it comes back to the question, why would I not want to focus on someone's good qualities? And why would I want to focus on their faults? And even if it brings me some kind of perverted pleasure, ultimately it's gnawing or it's undermining my spiritual advancement. So ultimately, it can't make me happy, but still, there's a desire to do it. And I think one of the problems that we all face as devotees is that we understand things. We learn from sadhus. We learn from shastra. We understand what is right and what is wrong, what is proper behavior and what is not proper behavior. But we don't always feel like acting that way. It doesn't have an emotional charge to it. It's just like, oh, I know I should do this. But on the other hand, I don't feel like doing it. I know I should go out and help people. I should be compassionate. But I don't feel like it. I know I should not find fault. Or I know I should honor devotees. But I don't feel like it. So unless we feel, unless it comes to the point of feeling, then how long can you continue just intellectually? You know, I'm going to be determined to not find fault, to just see the good in the other devotees. But inevitably, somebody does something that bothers us because we have that problem. And then we point it out, or we point it out to ourselves, and then we live in that critical world. So that's a big issue to deal with, of getting to the point of feeling. Because when there's feeling, like we say, when there's taste, everything is downhill from there. So if we go back to the original statement, and if we make that like our Paribhasa Sutra of humility, like this is the bottom line here. The bottom line is, I don't want to introspect. You know that quote, I think we mentioned it in another show, where Bhaktisiddhanta said, when others harm you, or when others bother you, introspect. Like he's saying, if someone else is bothering you, look at yourself. And said, no one can harm you unless you allow them to harm you. So I think he's saying the same thing. And he really put out, it seems from the writings that I've read of his, it really seems that he put out a lot on this topic of humility. He really got into it and spoke about it a lot, particularly in regards to introspection. Look at yourself. Look at what's wrong with you. And so some listeners may say, well, you know, why are you guys talking about this? Why are you, Prabhu's, talking about this? Because it seems like your other discussions have been like more in terms of how to get from point A to point B, and this seems to be a very internal thing. But I find this to be a major stumbling block in our spiritual progress.
How can you not see faults? Because, you know, especially people who are intelligent, they're very perceptive, so they can see everything. And like when intelligent people come to our movement, they immediately see, oh, this is bad in the management, oh, this preacher is proud, or he's self-righteous, and things like that. So how can you not see faults? You're not blind.
Well, I think there's an attitude in which you see those, and it's not necessarily that you're seeing the fault. What's the saying of Shastra, that the Vaishnava sees the best in a person, or a Christian takes out the essence, the good quality, doesn't see the bad? So that is possible. But you might say, well, that's not realistic because the bad is there. But how does a devotee see the bad? I think you made a really powerful statement when you were saying you were seeing defects in leadership, and then you thought, well, there's two things I can do. One is I can criticize, and the other is I could help. So let me learn what leadership involves, and then I can help them improve. So it was an attitude in which you approached it, which was very positive. So, okay, I see a defect. Okay, there's a defect there. But I see this devotee as a sincere person, as a sincere soul. But I might see he lacks education in a certain area, which is a little different than fault finding. But if it's raw, gross fault finding, then I think we have to go back to that statement of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, because I'm so full of fault, honeycomb with faults, I see it in others. It's a really powerful mantra. If you've spot it, you've got it. Because it's like something we don't want to believe, we don't want to buy into. But we see it. We see, if we step back and think about it, why would something really bother me unless I have it and it bothers me inside? And you know, a lot of times when I see devotees pointing out faults in others, what I think I'm seeing is that they're feeling, in a sense, that they couldn't come up to the level to be better than that person, and the only way to deal with it is to find fault with them. Why do they always do this? Why can't we have this? Why can't, as opposed to being proactive?
So we, is it that we tend to find fault in others because then we feel better or we feel higher?
That's one. I think again, if we go back to that statement, we don't want to look at our fault. So if I find a fault in you and it helps me avoid looking at a fault in myself that I don't want to deal with because for whatever reason it's so bad or so dark, or my false ego is so inflated that if I acknowledge that, it'll be like putting a pin in a balloon and I won't be able to take it, then I can get some pleasure by avoiding that. What they call that in the realm of psychology is suppressing the beach ball. You know what a beach ball is? It's like a balloon, kind mm-hmm. of. You know? So if you put it underwater, you go in the ocean and you put the beach ball underwater, but you have to hold it down.
Mm.
So it takes a lot of energy to hold down. So one of the reasons I wanted to discuss this topic was to help devotees realize that if you're not dealing with your faults and you're suppressing them, which means you're not acknowledging them, you're not allowing them to come to the surface, they stay within your subconscious or your unconscious mind. Number one, they'll play out in your life. And number two, you're putting out a lot of energy to hold the beach ball down. So one of the main reasons I wanted to talk about that is to show devotees that's a waste of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, which we touched on in another class, and I just read yesterday, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said it, and I was so happy to read it. He said, the process of glorifying the devotee is the process of purifying your own heart. So it's not just, like we could say, it's not just something we should do, but it's actually a process of purification. He said it's one of the most powerful processes of purification.
Wow.
So that being said, if we have the opportunity to either see the good or see the bad, we're really harming ourselves tremendously by not taking the opportunity to be amanina manadena without false prestige for myself and then offering respect to others. I mean, it's right there in that verse, everything we're talking about. Without looking, I don't want people to look at me and say, oh, you're great. I want to look at others and find that they're good. Okay, like you're saying, maybe they have bad qualities, but I think it says a lot about us. What's standing out, the bad or the good? Does it mean everyone who has bad qualities doesn't have good qualities? No, obviously not. So you could focus on the bad and not see the good.
Mm.
So you can focus on the good, and then the bad's not such a problem. And then you go back to your mantra, well, I should focus on the bad in myself rather than focus on the bad in another person. Now, I know you're saying, let's say the person's an authority and you see that they're upsetting the situation in a particular organization or temple and something needs to be dealt with. Again, I think it's how you approach that and your attitude. If, like, people ask me in the forgiveness course, you know, how do you deal with someone who did some horrible act that and they need to be rectified for it or taken to court? And how can you forgive them and at the same time process them through the legal channels or whatever channels to bring them to justice? And in my reflection on that, I feel that ultimately you can't properly do it unless you forgive them. Because if you forgive them, then your motive will not be vengeance. I'm taking you to court out of vengeance. No, I'm taking you to court because this will be, because what you've done is not safe for society, or you need to be rectified, and this can help you. So it's the heart of compassion. It's all the mood. So, you know, you can be critical in a proper mood, but it's not the same, and it doesn't have the same effect on you. Mm. It's out of your affection for the person.
Would you say that not being defensive is a sign of humility?
I would say that being defensive means that we're defending our false ego and our false image. And I want to tell you a story. It's a really nice story. And this comes from the Bible. And I don't know the exact verse. I think it's Psalms. But it's saying, if somebody points out a fault in you, they're giving you a valuable jewel. So the person who was commenting on this said that he was working for a company, and he had an assignment, and he thought he did it really well, and it was going to take the company to another level. He brought it to the boss, and the boss told him what was wrong with it. And he said, but he had learned this valuable advice, which Srila Bhakti Siddhanta basically said the same thing. If I criticize you, someone who criticizes you is your friend, someone who praises you is your enemy. So I didn't fully understand it as well as I did until I read this story. So what happened was, this person had read this verse of the Bible, and he had understood it, and he had accepted it. So when his boss came back, he thought his boss was going to come back with praise. He said, this is what's wrong with what you did, and it's going to fail for these reasons, and you need to do this, that, and that, or understand this is wrong. He gave him, basically, he deflated his ego, but this person's ego did not deflate. He accepted it. But for another person, he would have been defensive, a person who didn't understand the principle. So anyway, he took the advice. He redeveloped the project according to that advice, and that project became one of the most successful projects that company ever did. So he said, I'm so grateful that I got that feedback, because that feedback taught me so much. And if I had not understood the value of feedback, then I probably just would have walked out on it, or I wouldn't have done anything to improve. So there's that sum of thinking feedback is like a valuable gem. If you accept it, if you can honor it. But if we're defensive, then it's like we're throwing these gems away. So obviously it requires some humility. But my point again is, if a devotee wants to advance, then we would think logically he wants to be made aware of his faults. And it said that's the duty of the guru, is to find your faults, is to make you aware of your faults. That's the whole duty. Which is why being a guru is a thankless task, because the nature of a Vaishnava is not to find fault with another. And that's all the guru has to do. And then we told that story that someone came to Bhaktisiddhanta and they were finding fault with another devotee. And he said, it's my duty, it's a thankless task as guru to find fault. Why would you want to do it? Mm. For heaven's sake, why would you want to do something that I have to do because it's my duty?
What would be a humble way to react to a situation when you are accused for something that you haven't done?
Mm-hmm. You're accused for something you haven't done. I think...
Shall you be defensive or...
I think there are a number of ways of doing it, and I think ultimately the conclusion that any advanced devotee will come to, although they may not come to it right away, is that Krishna is involved here and I'm being accused for a reason. And I can't control it. It may have been something I've done in the past that's causing this. There's a lesson there. There's something I meant. It's going to be perhaps humiliating. It's going to make me more humble. Perhaps I want to control things too much and Krishna's just doing this. Perhaps in the future it will turn around and people will apologize and it will be a lesson to everyone, and my example will teach others that this is how to deal with it. I know people who've been through those situations, and I've seen what they've gone through, and I see that ultimately, although it's difficult, they do come to that point where they just say, this is Krishna. I don't know why. I may not know why now. Usually later on they know why he did it. And with a lot of these people, they went through a lot of difficulties and it ended up better. They ended up in a better position. They actually lost their position, their service, because of that. They were taken out of their service because they were falsely accused. And eventually they ended up in a better position. And they said, I see Krishna has taken me out. He had to do this to take me out of that service. So we have to, I think another thing is, if we're falsely accused, we need to be more in sync with the people that are accusing us, that they must be hurt by what they think we've done. They must think we're lying if we defend ourselves. You know, and it takes a lot of the energy away from the hatred that the person has towards us if we sympathize, empathize with them. You know, you think I've done this, you must be really hurt, you must be really angry with me, you must want to take me to justice, and you probably don't believe me, even if I tell you I didn't, and I don't know what else I can do, but if this is If you don't believe me, what can, you know? So we're taking the humble position, and I've seen also that one of the best ways we learn how to develop any quality is to see it in another, because it was pointed out to me that when you hear about a quality, it doesn't have the same effect as when you actually see it in the life of a person.
Mm.
So this one devotee told a story in which he went to see a very prominent guru, I believe in Vrindavan. And he had thousands of followers. He was, you know, very well known. And the devotee went to see him was a sannyasi, and when he got there, the guru got off his asana to greet him. He made sure he had water, had a nice seat. He was basically like stopped everything. His disciples came to serve the sannyasi. So the sannyasi said, you know, I heard about humility, I've studied about it, I've read about it. He said, but when I saw it, he said, it actually changed my heart. So it goes back to that point that I'm making, is if you understand something, it's one thing, but if you feel it, it's another. And a lot of times when we see a person behave in a humble way, or in a way that they're not defensive or their ego is not fighting back, it actually touches our heart. And then we become so impressed by that, we think, I want to be like that person. And then the desire, that feeling and desire, the same thing, that feeling comes. Because if we don't have a feeling, a desire to be humble, we can intellectualize it. You could listen to this conversation every day for the rest of your life. Unless there's some desire or some, you see it in a positive way, this is good, this is something I want to achieve, the false ego will just fight. It won't allow you. It'll try to kill you.
If I remain quiet when I'm accused for something I haven't done, then people will continue to accuse me, and they will continue to get on my case and continue basically to torture me.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what you're describing, it could vary according to the severity of the abuse you're getting and the ramifications of it. And so I gave a very general answer. But I said, you know, you can testify that you didn't do it. You can say, you can tell people they're making a mistake, and the ramifications of the mistake are going to hurt other people. And but still, at a certain point, when you see things are out of your control, what do? You have to acknowledge something's happening here, and something good will likely come out of it. But, you know, my understanding is, whatever situation we go through, we don't want to abandon our Vaishnava behavior and qualities. Because there are many situations which it's so easy. I'll tell you a story, and I think this story is really, really kind of illustrates this point. Not entirely, but it's an example. I was reading yesterday, Gaura Govindamaharaj was talking about Sharlata. Sharlata means simplicity. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta also talks about devotee being simple, which includes not being pretentious, not pretending to be something you're not, not being duplicitous, not acting one way but internally being different, not being a cheater, which if you're pretentious and duplicitous would mean you tend to be a cheater. So he said a devotee should be Sharlata, simple. So he told the story of this Digvijay, this scholar who wanted to conquer all scholars and become the number one scholar. So Dig means all directions, and Vijay means victorious. So he wanted to be victorious in all directions. So we all know the story. He went to Rupan Sanatan and said, I want to debate with you, and if I win, I want you to sign a paper saying that I defeated you. They said, no problem. We don't have to have the debate. We'll just sign the paper. So he was citing that as an example of simplicity. Now, just before that, a devotee wrote me an email and said he was on a train in India, and the conductor, at least appeared, was cheating him out of some money. And he got really angry with the conductor because the devotee said, I hate injustice. So he started yelling at him. And then the devotee said, I thought of you and thought of the things that you've taught me and the articles you've written, and I went back and I apologized to the conductor. So when I read the story about Rupan Sanatan, I sent him that story, and I said, I think this story illustrates the point that on a certain level, we just don't want to stoop low enough, like Rupan and Sanatan did not want to stoop to the level of this scholar who just wanted name and fame.
Mm.
So, you know, there's some injustice coming towards us, but and we see it, and we are innocent, and we know the other person is cheating. Do we want to stoop to their level? Or do we want to just be simple and say, you know, whatever, yes, sir. Even, I mean, I'm not saying we should do this, but I could even see some advanced devotees saying, yes, whatever you say is true. Not even, because we don't want to go to that level, because my business is Krishna consciousness, and I don't want to be deviated from that. So I think that story is wonderful in illustrating how in material affairs, you know, a lot of times I think what happens with devotees, we kind of compartmentalize Krishna consciousness. So with devotees, I act a certain way. At the temple, I act a certain way. In my ordinary affairs at work, I may be angry or disrespectful or whatever. And I think we have to understand Krishna consciousness must be applied everywhere. And so that's a principle of being simple. Just, you know, don't get into things that are going to disturb your mind. It's not useful. It's not worth the time. It's not worth the energy. Just as we're saying, it's not worth the energy to maintain your false ego. It takes energy, and it just diverts you.
What we see that is happening in life, what I have seen in my life and in lives of people I know, is that even if you don't want to look at your faults, you always get feedback about your faults, and people tell you somehow. Sometimes even a child can come and tell you something, and through some channel you get what you need to hear and what you need to change. So somehow we cannot avoid hearing what we need to change.
I just had a very interesting experience yesterday. I was walking into a store, and on the store was a picture of a girl who's been missing for the last few days. And she's 27, she's very attractive, and it was a picture of her from a couple feet above her shooting down. And she had a shirt which kind of exposed her breast a little bit. And I was looking at this picture, and I was thinking, and it said she was last seen at the bar, and I was thinking, oh my God, her parents must be like in total anxiety now. And I was thinking, why did she go to the bar? Because I have a daughter, and I think kind of, you know, what's going to happen to her in the future? And I'm looking at this picture, and I'm going, this girl is like, she's attractive, and, you know, she probably is intelligent and could be successful. Why is she hanging out at a bar alone? And what's going on? And what's happening with her parents? And as I was looking at the picture, this girl walked by me, walking into the store, and she said, stop looking down her dress. Stop looking down her blouse. I just laughed. I go, well, maybe that's why I was looking at it. And I was thinking, no, actually, I'm, you know, thinking from the point of view of a parent, but maybe I was actually doing that. So, you know, so I just laughed at it, and I go, Krishna must be speaking through this girl. Uh-huh. You know, say, Mahatma, don't look, you know, don't look at these things, you know. Or they say in the world of sexaholics, sometimes they look at, you know, there may be a magazine or something around with a woman in underwear or a swimsuit or something. And you know, it's like in the doctor's office or something, and they say jokingly, you look at the picture just to make sure that's the picture you're not supposed to look at. Uh-huh. So I thought, well, maybe that's what I was doing. Maybe I was actually more attracted to her, to this girl, and I just thought I was like looking from the point of view of a parent. But I've also been with my daughter, where she's said amazing things to me, things that were going on in my mind, and she had no idea, but it was Krishna. She would just say something, and I was like, it was like the perfect thing. So I always remember that story from Psalms where the person saw so much value in the feedback they got, and his whole point was, when you get it, treat it like a valuable gem. Whenever that feedback comes, treat it like a valuable gem, because it's an opportunity to improve. And the whole process of bhakti is that we want to improve, and that's my whole point. If we want to improve, then we're willing to look at our faults. And if we really want to improve, why are we wasting energy looking at other people's faults?
One way that we can work on improving ourselves by being proactive, taking initiative for this, is that we ask for feed forward. Opposite of feedback is feed forward. Instead of looking at what you have done wrong in the past, you can actually ask people, what can I do better in the future? So more or less it's the same thing, but it's just somehow maybe easier for the ego. And this one expert from whom I was learning, he developed the whole thing, how to, because he's dealing with people who have big egos, and then he developed this system of feed forward that give me one or two suggestions about certain issue for the future. And then I take it and I say, well, I'm going to do my best and then get back to you. Like if you tell me, you have to be a better listener. So I try to listen to you, and after 1-2 months I ask you, so how am I doing a listening? Am I listening better to you? And then you give me feedback, and based on this I can see whether I have made some improvement.
That's a great idea. Like you're saying, it's easier for someone to give you a suggestion about what to do better rather than tell you what you do wrong.
Yeah.
So let's say, well, how can I improve? Listen more to people. Listen better, be more empathetic, be more in their world, as opposed to saying, when you ask for feedback, well, the problem is you don't listen to people, and the problem is you're not empathetic. So basically, you're telling that person, you're just like a self-centered snob. So naturally, the person's going to be defensive. And plus, by telling them, you're telling them what to do, as opposed to telling them what they're doing wrong, which doesn't necessarily tell them what they're doing. And you've made the decision yourself. So, okay, these are the areas in which I can improve. I decide what I want to work on. So then if I'm getting feedback later, it's probably easier to get because, well, I'm working on it. I'm trying. Oh, yeah, well, you did well in this area. Need a little more improvement. So I think it's great. I hope the listeners got the idea that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, the fundamental principle that we should look at ourselves, our own faults, and if we don't, we're going to be looking at other people's faults. And if you spot it, you got it. That the things that really bother you in other people are really the things that are bothering you about yourself that you're not confronting. It's a very powerful principle. Because I'm so honeycombed with fault, I see it in others. So if you see something in others that bothers you, it's an issue you have to deal with. If you think this person is cheating, it might be that you have a conception. You may not be a cheater, but you may, at some level, consider yourself to be a cheater, or to be deceptive. I want to tell you one story just to illustrate this. There were two teachers, and they both taught a design shop, kind of like a wood design. So they had a lot of tools, and one teacher would lock all his tools in a case, and he would take those cases and he'd put those cases in a cabinet and he'd lock the cabinet. Then, of course, he'd lock the classroom door. Where another teacher didn't lock anything. He just had the tools open so the students could go anytime and get the tools. They could even take them home if they wanted. So the teacher who locks the tools went to the teacher who doesn't lock the tools and said, you must get a lot of your tools stolen. And he said, "Why? No, I don't. Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, I noticed that you don't lock your tools, and I lock mine twice, and I'm getting my tools stolen." And the other teacher who didn't lock them didn't get any of his tools stolen. Mm-hmm. Well, the other teacher later became a psychologist or went into that field. And he said, "My understanding was that this person did not trust the students. He had lack of trust. It was his own issue, lack of trust." And so the other teacher, his realization was, if you lack trust in people, then people will come to prove you true. They say self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
If you don't trust them, people will show up, say, well, you don't trust them, they're going to steal your tools. Where the other person, the other teacher, trusted the students. And so trusting people showed up. So here are all these students, which he could say, look at these students, they're so bad. They're cheating, they're stealing, they're taking the tools. But actually, that was in his heart. That's how he thinks. So so he's saying, a lot of people show up in your life so you can deal with the issues that you have, but you just find fault with them, you don't acknowledge it. So yeah, it is amazing. Something to think about. It's a big subject. So we're going to end here. If you'd like to learn more about this, contact either myself or Akura. You can get me at mahat@aol.com or mahatmadasa tsmith@gmail.com. And my website is T, like Tom, tstrain.com. Got a lot of articles on there. And Akura's website is vedicilluminations.com/Gita Coaching. And his email is akura@pamho.net, A-K-R-U-R-A. Thank you for listening. Hare Krishna.